Live from somewhere inside my sad little mind, it's the Mark Maron Show. And now he's got a border fence around his heart. Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim. Good evening, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, lurking conservatives, pain sponges and need machines, and users of cast iron waffle presses, waffle irons, cast iron waffle iron. Man, I tell you, I'm looking at our blog, I'm looking at my emails. Out of all things that we talk about on this show, pertinent and not so, the Teflon waffle iron debate and issue, Teflon waffle iron. Apparently, if you run the Teflon pan too hot, it'll kill your bird. Thank God all my birds are dead already. I don't have to worry about it killing any of my birds. Apparently, there are new coatings that won't kill your bird.
Yeah.
Teflon is bad. There was another link to a website that basically says Teflon is bad. Okay. Then someone sent me a picture of her granny's waffle iron, which was an old-style cast iron waffle.
Her granny's waffle?
Her granny's, yes, and what a waffle it was, Jim. Let me tell you. Yeah. I got to send you that link, but you got to make sure.
Okay.
Don't send it to anyone else, because it's one of those ones that opens up. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I won't go any further with
that. You started it. I thought you wanted to play.
And I don't want
to. I thought you came to play.
Touch that waffle with a 10-foot pole.
Really? I wouldn't touch it with your 10-foot pole.
Okay.
All right, here we go. It's a cast iron. And a lot of people, like, I can't believe I'm going to open up a show after a whole weekend of news unfolding talking about this, and maybe we should hold on to it, but you brought it up last week, and it got the bloggers and our emailers all excited. The waffle iron. My waffle iron is good. I think Teflon is bad, but not so bad if you're prudent with it. Apparently, some woman wrote me a letter talking about waffles and said I should certainly be more worried about the waffle iron, the Teflon waffle iron, than I am about aspartame and being a buzzkill to all the... She wrote this very pleasant letter.
Yeah.
I should have printed it up, but I didn't. I printed up some other ones about how she's enjoying the show, enjoying the conversations. Maybe I should be a little more worried about Teflon than I am about aspartame. And thanks for buzz killing all of the diabetics in this country with my aspartame rants on what she sees as questionable science.
You know what's a bigger buzz kill for diabetics?
What?
Cancer.
Cancer and heart disease and losing a limb, I'm thinking.
You know why? You know why people react so passionately to these issues?
Why?
Because food is incredibly
important,
personal to people.
It's important.
People learn their habits in their childhood, and it's like you're an affront to them or something, or it's a challenge, or it's they're afraid of change. Remember when you were 8 years old, and you would only eat hamburgers and French fries?
Yeah.
See, and you would cry if you had any new food. It's scary. It's a scary thing to change your eating habits.
Yeah.
And that's why we're all doomed.
Yeah.
Because people aren't going to ever change their eating habits. We're going to, the global warming is going to continue. The rainforests are going to die out for meat eaters and everything else. Teflon, cancer, every birds are dying, dropping like flies. But, you know, there is an upside to this whole thing.
Yeah.
Comedy.
Oh. I guess you're right, Jim. Let me try and turn this ship around. We had a nice trajectory going there, and then all of a sudden you became my dad. It started out good, too. I was like, yeah, everybody likes food, and then we're all having hamburgers there in the middle of it, and then, bam, all of a sudden everyone dies, and there's cancer, and there's no hope for anybody. Wow.
Well, you know.
Look, food is important because no one can say, I'm done with it. You know, and if they do, they got real sickness. But the truth of the matter is... I got a couple of cast iron pans that I'm very committed to. My wife thinks I'm obsessed with them. I season them like once or twice a month with lard. And
lard, really?
You have to. You got no choices. If you want to season a pan,
really?
Got to do it with lard.
Only animal fat?
Yeah, sorry, buddy. If you want to do it right, if you want to do it back like they used to do it to bring yourself back to the time where they invented seasoning pans.
Back when they had slaves.
But whatever. It's got no, that has no bearing on the...
Back
the,
when the slaves did it.
Anyways.
You're not saying you're in favor of slavery, are you?
No, I'm not, Jim. I'm saying that you need a little
hard to clear that up.
But I'm very much into cast iron cookware. Look, we've got to move on. I was part of a tremendous movement this weekend. I was part of something big, Jim.
What?
I was part of something big. Well, the Da Vinci Code was one of the best debuts of the year, if not the best, and I was part of that. My money was involved in that. And I went to see the movie, and I learned something about myself.
What?
Finally. And I think I'd learned it before, but there was no hostility at all involved in my re-education, which is that I sat through that movie. It's about 2.5 hours long, and I got to be honest with you. I really just don't care about Jesus. And I don't know if that's bad or if it's wrong, but you really have to have something, somewhat of an investment in the whole Jesus thing, mm-hmm. in order for this movie to be compelling to you. Because outside of that, it's fairly hackneyed. You know, the transitions are overworked. What do I want to say? The transitions in the film, getting from one place to another, are ridiculous. Plot points, retarded. But I think if you had Jesus in your life or you ate him as a child, that it would resonate with you even if you're not into the Jesus anymore. But me coming to it just as a secular Jew who has no real God education, was not trained like a dog by my parents to believe in something bigger than me. It fell a little flat because I just wasn't that enchanted with the idea of the story. And outside of that, it was a little hacky, and the plot points were tired, and kind of the transitions were choppy.
Kind of like the Bible.
Well, that was Ian McKellen's point, and he was very ballsy, can I say that, in making that point, that the Bible should have a disclaimer. If you want to put a disclaimer on the film saying this is fiction, mm-hmm. so should the Bible, which is all well and good. But I'm just talking from a movie point of view, the guy who played the albino, not scary or weird enough. I mean, in The Coming Attractions, you're thinking, wow, this guy's going to be a really weird albino freak. But he's not. It's that good-looking guy from the Mel Gibson boat movie in the Beautiful Mind movie,
really?
You know, that English guy with the white hair and contact lenses on. Who? That's not a real freak. You know, and I'm not saying albinos are freaks, but I'm saying if you're going to use an albino,
right.
you know, take it to the limit. You know what I'm saying?
Did this one have special powers?
He was mean. He was a mean albino monk that was turned out by a priest because he was in prison, and he had killed his dad, I think. I saw that in a flashback. I don't know. And what was interesting is a lot of the kids I was sitting there with, these drunk kids, they were Latino metalheads who were all sitting in a row next to me. And they there was a couple moments in the movie that were like, no way, when the albino did something really crazy that was completely sacrilegious. But I get the feeling that they had Jesus beveled into their heads when they were kids. There's a pretty good chance.
I'm sure they did, you know.
And that was very exciting to them to see the actual sacrilege of the movie in action. I think that's why they went. But I found it, even in terms of transgression and sacrilege, to be a little disappointing. Got to be honest with you.
Not very interesting, huh?
Not very interesting and not cryptic and weird enough. And there was, you know... Again, albino was very disappointing, and Tom Hanks was fair, and the French girl was a French woman. It was all right. There was, you know, McKellen was great, and he's always great, but it doesn't matter what he's in. He could be eating toast. We got to go. We got to do a show. We got things We got short order news to do. Nothing happened. We went. We took an arc with waffles and talked about the Da Vinci Code. Now we're coming up short on the jokes. Hell with it. Let's do the jokes now. A lot happened in the world today. We don't want you to be caught off guard, so here's today's first edition of the Short Order News. Federal investigators revealed in court papers that they videotaped Louisiana Democratic Representative William Jefferson accepting a leather briefcase packed with $100,000 in cash from a government witness in a bribery investigation. And that's just a setup. The FBI reported that Jefferson was receiving money from Nigeria, which is the first time an American asked a Nigerian for money since the beginning of the Internet. That's one of the references to those funny emails that people get. Voters reelected Ray Nagin as mayor of New Orleans, giving him 4 more years to oversee one of the largest rebuilding projects in U.S. history. The vote between Nagin and white opponent Mitch Landrieu split largely along racial lines. And in his victory speech, Nagin thanked all of the chocolate voters of New Orleans. This fall, Christie's will hold the first official studio auction of memorabilia from all 5 Star Trek television series and 10 movie spinoffs. Set your phasers on overpriced. Auctioneers of Christie's have already warned fans that everything must be paid with American dollars and not Triskelion Quatloos or Ferengi Latinum or Klingon Darsex. Not accepting any of those currencies.
Darsex,
is that... All right, look, that's the Short Order News. We will be back. We're going to be talking to Rory O'Connor about an interview he had with Judith Miller that reveals something about her that we didn't know. Greg Weiss from GQ on the pathetic Democrats. His words, not mine. Jim Donahue, co-founder of Halliburton Watch, which is a brilliant organization. We will be back in a minute.
keeping $100,000 in cash in his crock pot. Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim. We're going to talk about the press. We're going to talk about Judith Miller. We're going to talk about a lot of things, given that our president this morning said, quote, freedom is moving in Iraq, but it's in incremental steps, and the enemy's progress is almost instant on their TV screens, end quote. What does that mean? I assume it's a shot at the press.
Yeah.
Rory O'Connor is a documentary filmmaker and journalist. His articles have appeared in magazines, including Rolling Stone, Mother Jones, The Nation, Newsweek, Details, many others. He is the co-author of an award-winning nonfiction book entitled Nuke Speak, The Selling of Nuclear Technology in America. He's also an award-winning filmmaker and broadcaster. A lot of his new films are exploring globalization and poverty in and around the world. He's here to tell us about an interview he had with New York Times reporter Judith Miller that might make her seem even more evil than she already seems. Welcome to the show, Rory O'Connor.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure.
I'm glad you're here. When did this interview with Judith? Now, most of our listeners know that Judith Miller is a woman that did jail time for not revealing her sources. She's also the woman that that disseminated what is now to be pretty well established as false information from bad sources that may have initiated some of the support for this bad war. Now, you interviewed Judith Miller. When did this happen?
Yes, both of those are true. We interviewed Judith Miller, and in fact, this entire interview was on videotape, and it took place about a week and a half ago. And just very quickly, I first want to make the point that this is not Judith Miller's idea. This was our idea, our request. She did the interview reluctantly and against the express advice of her attorneys. So this is not Judith trying to, you know, reinvigorate her career or inject herself into the news.
Now, you were there, Rory O'Connor, representing Media Is a Plural, your blog.
That's correct. My blog and also MediaChannel.org, which is, our super site, if you will, about all things media related.
And the premise of the interview was what?
Well, what we had found, I should mention my co-author, Scott Malone, on this. Scott and I found that in 2001, a still anonymous White House source leaked top secret, still classified NSA intelligence to Judith Miller to the effect that Al-Qaeda was planning a major attack on the United States. This is 2 months before the attacks of 9/11. And, amazingly enough, the story, like the Valerie Plame story you referred to earlier, was never written and never made it into the paper.
Well, that's fascinating to me because Judith Miller, if she had that information, not unlike the August 12th presidential daily briefing that one went unwarranted, and also this is the woman that's more than ready to take information as questionable if it operates to support this particular administration, it would seem that she's almost criminal to me.
Well, I think what happened, if you read the story, you'll see that her editor, Stephen Engelberg, mm-hmm. who is now at the Oregonian as the managing editor, quite rightly said that she didn't have enough details to go to press, perhaps, with the story initially. And he sent her back to get further details. He said, go back, go to the CIA, go to the NSA, get more details on this. The amazing thing to me is that Judy did go back and try for a short period of time to get further details, but she says that Washington being Washington and the counter-terror world being the CT world, I was soon off pursuing other things. In Washington, if you don't have a sense of immediacy about something, and if you sense there is bureaucratic resistance to a story, you tend to focus on areas of less resistance. So here she was, having been told that there was an NSA intercept saying there was going to be a major attack on the United States, and when she had a little difficulty from the bureaucracy, she decided to do easier stories instead of pursuing this one.
Now, do you think that is a condition of the Washington reporter or all reporters in general when it comes to editors? Because when you're talking about someone like Judith Miller, who seemed to have a strange amount of access, certainly to this administration, and somebody and a reporter who is working the political beat, that they're up against breaking things that could literally derail politics, whereas other journalists are just, you know, working at the behest of editors anywhere. But do you think this is a condition of working in Washington that it is a liability for the reporter?
I think everything about this interview that we published reveals a great deal about the nexus of media and politics and how the power game is played in Washington. I mean, Judy basically comes out in the interview and says, I was questioning why were they giving me this information? And she explains that the counterterrorism officials in Washington were leaking the information to her in hopes that she would put it in the New York Times and thus enable them to get the attention of their higher-ups in the White House, including the president.
That's unbelievable. So in essence, it's almost like if you were pitching a movie to me, Rory O'Connor, which you're not,
I do have a screenplay, though.
Okay, good. Well, I got a friend I can give it to.
Okay, great.
Well, look, you got a woman who is in some ways at the crossroads of good and evil. Yeah, whereas if she was to make the choice to go with the NSA guy and fight for the truth on that level, it might have saved us from, maybe from 9/11 and perhaps from having the information that helped lead to this administration going into war. But she made the other choice. She decided to cozy up to this administration and provide information that came from shoddy intelligence sources.
Well, you know, you have a good point. I can only say that both she and Engelberger are on the record this interview as expressing deep regrets. Now, of course, hindsight, as we know, Mark, is always 20/20. So, you know, it's easy to look back now after 9/11 and say they should have run the story. You know, that's an editorial call. But what I do think that she should have done is worked harder to try and get those details. And failing that, both she and Engelberg now, in hindsight, say, maybe we should have run with what we had, no matter how incomplete. That's, you know, in the world of journalism, that's an arguable decision. But I think that, to answer your question, that when you're at a very high level, i.e. the White House and the New York Times, investigative reporters in that milieu certainly operate in a vastly different world than the lowly one that I inhabit.
Right. Now, let me ask you one more question. Maybe we should just wait till we come up on the break. Before I ask that question, do you think that she was ever or is a good journalist?
You want to wait for the break for that answer? It's a long one.
It's a long one? All right, let's do that. Hang on the phone. We're with Rory O'Connor. The website is Media is a Plural, and then we've got a link to it on my site. So stay with us. We're going to get into this and also get into a little bit about what leaks and what confidential sources are and why they're necessary in the journalism game. So hang out.
Now save time and postage. Mark Maron.
Thanks, Jim. We're on the phone with Rory O'Connor, a journalist from Media is a Plural. We're talking about Judith Miller and his interview with Judith Miller. And if you're just tuning in, she seems to me, from what I'm gleaning, she and her editors had an option. They were at a crossroads where they could have went with the National Security Administration and disseminating information about a possible terrorist attack, or go with the neocon agenda and distribute information based on questionable sources that help buttress the movement towards war. So, Rory, do you think what happened to her?
Well, look, I mean, the essence of this story that we tell is that this is yet another leak of highly classified information by a top executive. Now, let's look at the situation with leaks. After all, the Attorney General, Alberto Torturer Gonzalez, yesterday again called for jailing reporters who receive this sort of information. But let's look at the pattern of leaks. You know, leaks are okay if the president makes them and they benefit the White House.
Right.
That doesn't seem to be a problem.
Or he could just change the law if he wants and make it accommodate whatever the hell he says, no matter whether it's against the law or not.
Right. Well, yeah. I mean, you know, to quote President Nixon, this president seems to feel that if the president does it, that means it's not illegal.
Right.
So you have these leaks from on high. Then you have leaks such as the one I described in this story, which is when certain parties in the White House or in the administration feel that it's important to get the attention of the rest of the White House and they're not succeeding. So they leak it to the New York Times as a way of getting it injected into the political dialogue in the White House. The problem is The third category of leaks, which are leaks simply for the public knowledge and public benefit, oh, if we have those, let's jail the reporters and throw away the key.
So that's interesting.
So this is a very self-serving way of leaking information.
So you're saying that if the reporter is not being used by one contingent or another within the political system to get their message across, and that has its own repercussions, if they're just trying to get information out to the populace about something that they should know in terms of injustice or information or truth, that's where this particular administration sees that they're a liability.
Well, that's absolutely, and they are mounting an attack on the media that is really unprecedented, even much worse than the Nixon days of, Spiro Agnew going after the nattering nabobs of negativity. This is something that every investigative journalist that I know is quite worried about and quite cognizant of the fact that just by virtue of doing your job, by being in receipt of classified leaks, you're looking at possible jail time.
It's unbelievable. So, Rory, now even today, the president took a shot at the press. What do you think is the hope? In the future, since you seem to be on the pulse of how the press operates and what's going on. Because now we have a situation where you got someone like Jason Leopold, who's going to be on my show in a couple of weeks. He put out this piece about Rove's lawyer, yes. Ruskin. You read about it, right? Spending all this time with Fitzgerald that they claim it wasn't, that he didn't spend this time. And when you have, like, bloggers and you have the mainstream press and the credibility of both seems to be diminishing, what happens? Where are we?
Part of the problem, Mark, is this 24/7 news cycle we're in and this insane desire to be first, even if it's by a few seconds.
Mm-hmm.
It's much more important to be right than to be first. And as the great American philosopher, to paraphrase him, Yogi Berra, said, it ain't over till it's over, and you ain't indicted until you're indicted.
Right. Well, I think that is a big part of the problem, is the 24-hour news cycle where information became more, you had to have it quicker as opposed to a thorough or investigated properly or within a context.
Yeah, I mean, what's the hurry in letting the world know, whether Rove is being indicted at 5:05 on Friday or 5:07? We're going to know soon enough. And also, this diverts attention from the real story. Everyone is now talking about Jason Leopold. Was he right? Was he wrong?
Right.
And Rove, this and that. And let's not be diverted. Let's focus on the real issues in the case.
Which is that you have high-level White House officials who are guilty of perjury, if not conspiracy, and the vice president should probably be pushed out of office, if not, forced to resign, and the president.
And even beyond because let's not forget that the perjury and the obstruction of justice charges against Libby and potentially against Rove are also an outgrowth of the fact that they were, leaking classified information to the effect that, Valerie Plame was an undercover CIA operative.
And that compromised intelligence revolving around the nuclear capacity of Iran and the shipments of nuclear devices out of there. Yeah,
that's right. And as you know, there's an entire law that was passed to prevent this sort of activity after Philip Agee years ago started naming CIA agents.
Oh, yeah? Which law?
The Intelligence Identification Act.
Right. Man, I don't know. Now, what is your hope? I mean, where do you find hope, Rory, in terms of the press?
My hope is for regime change, frankly.
Absolutely.
I think that President Bush made many mistakes, but one of his most surprising was not canceling elections. quite frankly, and I'm sort of half joking, but I'm half serious. I really feared that at a certain point in time that he would use the war on terror as an excuse to say, look, just temporarily, but our country is under attack. We need to declare martial law or something like that. I have hope that in November of this year, the voters are going to speak. And they're going to send a message loud and clear to the administration, and we can at least get one of the houses of Congress, perhaps, in the hands of the other party. Obviously, we have to wait until 2008 election for true regime change.
Right.
But, barring that, I think you can look at, two more years of an all-out assault on the media.
Oh, we'll keep fighting the fight. Thanks a lot for joining us, Rory O'Connor.
Thank you. Keep up the good work, too.
Okay, take it easy.
Bye.
So, there you go. Man.
Two more years.
Woo! But come on. We got to go. We got more interviews to do. We got Greg Weiss from GQ, and he's going to crap on the Democrats. But, from our side. So I guess that's okay, right?
Yeah. Now he found a microchip in his thigh. Mark Maron.
I was just poking around down there. Sure enough, found it in my spine.
Yeah. Thigh.
Oh, thigh. Right, thigh. That's it. Yeah, I found one there, too. I'm loaded with them. Yeah. They're all over me.
Invasion of your privacy.
It's horrendous.
That's what I'm getting at.
Hey, as you know from listening to this show, and it's just the nature of who we are sometimes, it is not unusual for Democrats to player hate, given that there is reason to. In the new issue of GQ, they don't mince words with the piece, Those Pathetic Democrats. One of the contributors to the article, Greg Weiss, is on the phone with us. How are you, Greg?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's nice to have you. Did you do a lot of homework on this piece, Greg?
I did some homework.
All right. So was there a time when the Democrats were great?
Well, there was a time where they were certainly much, much better.
Yeah. When was that?
You know, going back to, the 40s, FDR, New Deal,
sure.
Truman, Kennedy.
Uh-huh.
Those, we look back at those as the glory years now.
And what the hell happened?
Oh, so much.
Uh-huh.
It's just scary to think about.
Yeah. Now, where do you think they dropped the ball?
There's a lot of ways to get at it. I think kind of the main one recently, obviously, has been, security.
Mm-hmm.
The post 9/11 world, Bush completely hammered the Democrats in 2002 on being weak on security, and then
right.
again in 2004.
Right.
And the Democrats haven't been able to come back with kind of a coherent strategy of their own to call Bush out on some of his own security BS in Iraq and on so many of his bungles.
Don't you feel like that they can't seem to get a cohesive platform together that they can all stand on? You got people like Lieberman and Clinton, and you got people moving towards this non-existent middle trying to pander to Republicans, and then it seems like there's only a few, certainly in the Senate, that really stand up for Democratic principles. I mean, Feingold is Feingold. He's the guy that's standing up for something that is not compromised.
He really is. He's been fantastic throughout this, throughout the entire Bush administration, from the Patriot Act to the censure to all the war votes. He's been pretty much the only guy in the Senate who's been who's had, like you said, the spine to stand up for democratic principles.
So what in your article, what are some of the examples you have in the piece about, dropping the ball and what we could have done instead?
Yeah, I think one of the interesting ones recently has to do with ethics reform.
Yeah.
Because finally, the Abramoff thing comes out.
Right.
Republicans are being exposed to
right.
this terribly corrupt, bloated party, which they are. And the Democrats had a chance to actually, it says in the article, marry good policy with good politics. People were hungry for some kind of change on the Hill.
Yeah.
And because, significant change would have messed with their plans when Democrats eventually take back the House or the Senate.
Right.
They went ahead with kind of toothless reform package, and what we have is pretty much business as usual, which is just a terrible shame.
Yeah, and what about what do you think in terms of the way the Democrats vote? Now, I'm assuming that you're not necessarily a journalist, are you? Do you consider yourself a journalist or a commentator?
we'll say journalist for today.
Okay, all right. So I'm just trying to figure out how biased I can get you to be.
Hey, I'm a Yeah, it changes day to day. So,
well, then that's an interesting question. What does it depend on for you, in terms of who impresses you politically when you were doing the research on this about Democrats? That there was obviously a history in the Democratic platform of looking out for the underdog, of making sure people in this country are taken care of civil rights in all this. That it seems to me that we're at a perfect precipice now to get some of that back.
Absolutely. And but that's another interesting thing about the Democratic Party is the complete lack of interesting leadership.
Oh yeah, I know.
you know.
What about Barack Obama? He sort of disappointed everybody. He was like, you know, he was out of the gate. He was the guy that was going to be the great savior of the Democratic Party. Now he's just sort of being a little cagey and just being.
It's still early for Barack. I still have great hope for him. And okay. I was going to say out of so many of the Democrats that he's the one that I'm still pinning my hopes on, as I guess so many people are.
What do you make of the Clinton appeal to the Republican majority and also the Republican business base to kind of, you know, get some money and get some approval?
It's just electoral politics. I mean, I guess what was disappointing for me in researching this piece is that, I mean, there's just a huge problem with the two-party system. I mean, no matter where your ideology stands,
yeah,
the parties are just completely corrupt, disgusting entities right now. And they end up having to pander to the business interests, or to the middle, or to the far right, or to the far left. Like, it seems like there's very little room for principle, and particularly in the Democratic Party now.
I don't find anyone really pandering to the far left that much,
no.
As far as business interests are going. You know,
this is fair.
They're trying to do it with this network, and I'm telling you, the pandering part to the far left, there's not a lot of huge money on the far left, per se, because...
Yeah, not so much. But at the same time, I mean, there's influence.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, the far left or the left, I mean, I think what you're saying is true, and Jim and I, my co-host here, have talked about that. A third party would be great if they could re-deliver this governmental system back to the people and actually get people that believe they want to represent people.
Sure. I mean, the question really is how. I mean, how do they build up the money?
All right,
money,
well, what's the answer? What's the answer, Greg Veast? Come on, man. We've been trying to answer this for years.
That is a very, very difficult question.
Will you get back to me on it?
You need a couple mavericks
who
have huge money. You need guys like Soros and just other huge money guys who can fund this party at the beginning.
Yeah.
And hopefully it can, you know, pick up some steam and snowball and...
Okay.
You know, and maybe it'll be a party that actually is representative of most Americans.
Okay, let me make sure I got this straight. Get huge money.
Huge money. That's
guys.
It. I know, this is a huge issue.
Big money. You get huge money from a guy with a lot of money to put that money into somebody who is going to behave properly in the political spectrum for the people and not for money.
We need the Kennedys again, I think.
Well, this is...
We still got one.
We still got one.
And then we got this new generation of Kennedys. There's a couple there that aren't bad. One of them's on our network.
There's some Roosevelts left.
Oh, right? And I think there's a Rockefeller, but they're not the good guys.
No longer.
No. But Jay Rockefeller's not horrible, is he?
No.
Okay. So we need a lot of money. All right. Well, I'm going to write these down.
I wouldn't write your congressman about that one quite yet. It's still being worked out.
Well, maybe I could just call George Soros and say, is there any way that you can, you know, just get on with it and make everything okay again? You own the world, you and a couple other people. I think it's time for it to be in your camp now. That's what needs to happen. We want the guy that we like with a lot of money to take care of things.
Exactly.
All right. Well, this has been very enlightening, Greg. I appreciate it.
I'm sorry. This is that was a little weak. I'll even admit over here.
What do you mean? The whole interview or what we came up with?
Oh, what I came up with there. There's a lot of ways that the third party can happen, but
okay.
The first one, money.
Okay. Well, I appreciate it. I enjoyed the article. It was funny, and it had a good edge to it, and I'll talk to you again soon.
Appreciate it.
Thanks, Greg.
Have a good one.
All right. The article's in this month's GQ, The Pathetic Democrats. Dude, I'm a mess today. I don't know what it is.
I don't
know
you
if
got
it's
something.
Monday.
You're distracted. I can tell.
Well, I just didn't know where that was going with that guy. You know, I mean, I could see the information that we got in the magazine. You know, I could see what he's got. It's a couple pages here. But, I mean, I could have done that. And I'm not knocking him. He seems like a nice enough fella. But
I don't even know if that was the real guy.
What do you mean the real guy? You think there's a Greg Veast imposter that's giving us that information?
I think Charlie didn't get the right guy on the line. And he asked somebody else from the call from the
Yeah, there's somebody
the
out
door.
Front. It's just a guy who works here at the studio.
Yeah.
He's going to...
The guy who sells candy out
but,
in front of the
But you know what is interesting, studio. Though, is that you've got this congressman that was busted. Now, this guy's a Democrat, though, but he said mm-hmm. something very interesting to me that I think is indicative of the way politics is now and the way government is run. This guy, Representative William Jefferson, he's a Democrat from Louisiana. He got busted on a videotape for accepting $100,000 in $100 bills, $90,000 of which was in his freezer. Fine. Let it be guilty. If he's guilty, he's guilty. And there's other people involved in the bribes. I don't even want to get into the nuances of it. I mean, you know, corruption is not unique to any particular party. It is something that politicians, you know, struggle with and are guilty of all the time. Now, this guy is not as big a guy as the guys they busted on their side, and I don't even want to get involved in that. I'm not going to underplay it. But what he did say when he was asked, when the informant asked Jefferson about his political plans, this guy, Jefferson, responded, quote, "I'm going to get your deal out of the way, and it probably won't last long after that," end quote. So he knew that, you know, by getting this money, by getting his kids, you know, options in this stock in Nigeria, or the telecommunications company, whatever the details of it are, it's not my job to report the news. It's my job to report the attitude of this guy, because I believe this is the real crime of politicians at this point in history. I'm going to get your deal out of the way, and I probably won't last long after that, end quote. That all he could care about was, I've been in here a long time, or I've been in here for as long as I have, and I'm going to make this work for me. Mm-hmm. There's an opportunism at the heart of corruption that entitles politicians to think that I'm here to get whatever I can for me, to get my connections in so I can have a career after I do this, to get my my relationships with these moneyed people in order so I can guarantee myself a certain amount of money. If it's legal, it's legal. If it's not, screw it. I'll take the risk. People have gotten away with worse. But that's the attitude, is that these are opportunists that are just completely, as Greg V said, and as we say on this network all the time, pandering to business interests to better themselves. Who the hell? I can't even imagine, outside of a crisis or a tragedy happening, where I've seen an example of a politician actually doing something in earnest for the people of his constituency, for regular people.
Because I don't think they're encouraged to. I don't think the system encourages people or attracts people, because they, you know, it beats them down. They spend most of their time, Congress, spending most of their time outside of Congress, trying to make money for their reelection. And there's a system. And if their main preoccupation is money, then they're not going to care that much about anything else.
I think there's a fundamental selfishness involved in it, too. I think that a lot of it falls on us, on me, on you. What is anyone's civic responsibility? And why do we assume that because politics may bore us, or politics may not be engaging, or we might not understand things about politics, that we don't have a responsibility to engage in our civic duty? You know, i.e. paying taxes, i.e. Investigating politicians, i.e. getting involved on a grassroots level. I'm guilty of it too. I'm guilty of not doing things. But it seems like there's a tremendous, there's a drop off in terms of what people really expect from their government. I think it has something to do. The reason why religious fanatics are so well mobilized is that they think they're answering to God. And when you have a secular based culture that answers to, you know, the rational being of man, it's very easy to get selfish and think that you don't have to do things and that you don't have to be involved in this process. But I think one of the reasons why democracy is dying, let's not go crazy with this right now. I'm going to pick it up later. I want to spin the wheel of anger. Can we? Let's have it. Give it a spin. And Jim's Wheel of Anger lands on Las Vegas. When we come back, we'll get into Las Vegas on the Jim Earl Wheel of Anger.
Make money in your own home. Mark Maron.
Guy, unbelievable. Greg Veese. Democrats, you know, Roosevelt, that was a good one. Those were the good Democrats. I'm not mocking the guy, but I am kind of. It sounded like a guy who just, you know, researched an article and had very little. But remind me after we do, you get done with the Wheel of Anger, this whole idea about secular and non-secular thinking in terms of political philosophy and why I think there's stagnation in terms of just regular people being involved in the political process has something to do with selfishness and has something to do with thinking oneself is more important than one's civic responsibility.
You mean a secular?
I just had this weird realization that people who are religious fanatics, who believe in God and that God's will must be done on earth and they have to initiate that, you know, the Bible should be the Constitution. The reason they're so mobilized is they feel like they're part of a greater agenda. They feel like they're part of God's agenda. So they really believe that, and that's why they have so much momentum and why they chip away at a grassroots level in the political process, school boards, state legislature, yeah. that kind of stuff. Whereas when you have secular thinkers, people that believe in the separation between church and state and that that should be honored and that people's belief is their own damn business and what should be legislated is a country based on laws and a constitution, is that I think it's easier for those people to just not just for secular people to say, yeah, the government, I vote sometimes, is that they don't feel connected, whereas they should be believing in or reinvigorating the democratic process, the democracy that we have in place or that needs change, as something they believe in a very dire way, that this is our political system. We have to fight for it, and it has to work properly for all of us people. But a lot of people are like, I don't know, politics. I mean, what's that guy's name? Yeah, I mean, that's sort of what you're up against. Whereas I think if people were excited about it or believed that it could be salvaged or had some awareness about the process or what their responsibility to that process was, it would kind of reinvent itself, that democracy might have a fighting chance. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, I think you're trying to say it's a conflict, the age-old conflict between dogma and logic.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Actually, in logic, people who tend to lean towards logic get kind of lazy.
Yeah.
Because they don't have dogma, you know, enslaving them.
That's kind of interesting.
Like rats.
Yeah, and also they kind of just get sort of like, you know, well, I'm good. You know, I'm okay. My desk is neat. Do you want to do the Wheel of Anger? I mean, I think we made a point there.
Yeah, sure.
I was very excited about the point when I started it, and then I don't know.
We can continue later, or we can talk about, you know.
The guy from Halliburton Watch is going to be here for like a half hour to really show everybody just, I mean, you know, Halliburton's kind of discussed as like this, you know, all evil corporation. And you know what? It's true.
So is he going to be like, Halliburton is... You know, Democrats just got to get off their, you know, butts and tell Halliburton stuff.
Halliburton, there's people in the office there that work.
Yeah.
You got regular people over there.
Corporation, they're crooked.
Yeah.
But, you know.
Yeah.
Sometimes
they have computer problems over there, which, you know, cause bad things. And...
Dude, sup?
Yeah. Sup, man?
Sup, man?
So sometimes you see Cheney walking down the hall. One guy will stick his head out of his office and go, "Sup, man? It's Cheney. That's Vice President, dude.
Dude.
Aha.
I'm out here in the hallway.
Hey, Cheney, dude, come on. What's going on? Hey, don't run too fast down the hall, Cheney, man. You got that ticker problem. That kind of stuff. Get on with the Wheel of Anger, Jim.
Okay, this is the Wheel of Anger. Mark.
Yeah.
I know you thought today's Wheel of Anger was going to be about Las Vegas.
Yeah.
Well, I changed my mind. I'll do that next week. Get over it.
Okay.
I'm not your Wheel of Anger puppet. But enough on that. Can I just say this? This country is pathetic. Listen to this. According to the National Trust for Historic Preservation, a battered staircase used by hundreds to flee the falling World Trade Center is now officially one of the most endangered historical places in America. Hey, you know what? I lived in New York for 8 years. I was there that day. And there are more important things this country is in danger of losing besides that staircase. Like my patience!
Yeah.
I'm sorry, but our long national nightmare of gratuitous self-pity is over, people. Every week, countries all over the world lose thousands of people. Whole villages are lost every time a ferry boat sails in the Congo. Remember Bhopal?
Yeah.
60,000 dead when DuPont attacked them with gas. How about Fatty Arbuckle? His career died along with thousands of others when Coca-Cola attacked a prostitute with a bottle.
Mm.
I ask you, where's their survivor staircase?
Mm-hmm.
We're not special, so we got attacked. Walk it off!
Wow.
Yeah.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. Sets my anger. Now we're spending $1 billion to turn Lower Manhattan into some weepy memorial like Washington, D.C. It's the most expensive tombstone in history. At least the pyramids were stuffed full of prizes. Couldn't that money be better spent around the country on fat prisons to save millions of obese Americans from cancer and almost certain humiliation by Dr. Phil?
Yes.
Which brings me to my next subject,
mm-hmm.
John McCain. Senator McCain, you've used up your torture credits.
Come on.
It wouldn't matter if you were suspended by deerskin knots through holes in your chest like a man called horse.
Yeah.
You supported George Bush in 2 elections, had your nose anointed with Jerry Falwell's poop. Now you'd like to keep us in Iraq longer than that crappy song, "Who Let the Dogs Out," has been playing in my head? Well, no! It's time to let the dream die. Bush will never help you. You're never going to be president, and the Green Bay Packers are still pissed off you gave their names to the Viet Cong. Let's face it, you crashed two jets and spent most of the war collecting a fat paycheck in prison. Not only that, you're expensive and you're lazy. Oh, and one more thing. Charlie! But even worse than that, I just bought a trowel that was made in China. Mm. Can't this dumb, stupid country even make a trowel? It's just a stupid little shovel-faced tool people use every day to dig up manure, you know, like Greta Van Susteren. It's not that hard, Mark. What I'm trying to say is this. Yeah. If you want to build a fitting memorial to the victims of 9/11, first off, stop using the term 9/11. Then spend that $1 billion assembling a revolutionary force armed with American-made trowels. And use that force to plant tasty weed in every town and city in the U.S. until we all have hair like that bass player for Jimi Hendrix. If you can't understand what I just said, maybe it's because you've just taken a ride on my wheel of anger. I'm Jim Earl, and you've been Earled.
All right. I get it. So now we move along. Jim Dunhill will be in here from Halliburton Watch.
Now his fumes may be harmful. Mark Maron.
You're telling me. Here we go, folks. It's Monday. Are we having a Monday? Do you have a case of the Monday? What is that? Isn't that office talk? Is it like, what is it?
It must be Monday.
I spilled coffee twice today. Okay? Twice. I'm trying to use my new computer. I'm trying to make that work for me. I've got it here in the studio. I bought a Macintosh computer for the first time. It just goes off if it sits too long, right? Isn't that the deal?
Well, it's called going to sleep, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Every computer does that.
No, I know. My other one did, but I remember my other one had something flying around when it did it.
You can have that on yours, too.
I think I broke it already. Hey, folks, when people use the company Halliburton as a catch-all corporation for everything that is bad about this administration and the neocon agenda, they really aren't that far from the truth. The organization Halliburton Watch has just released Hurricane Halliburton, Conflict, Climate Change, and Catastrophe, their alternate annual report for the company. They've also just issued a demand that Dick Cheney divest all his remaining stock in the company because it is a conflict of interest. Here with us is the co-founder of Halliburton Watch, Jim Donahue.
How you doing?
I'm good, Jim. Now, I didn't realize that he was still allowed to have actual stock. I thought it was all done in some subversive, illegal way in terms of continuing investment in the company, like through his family or other people.
No, he's allowed to have as much stock as he wants in Halliburton.
Really?
Sure.
Welcome
to America.
That seems crazy right off the bat. Now, you have actually just recently issued a demand. Is it a demand? How would you say it?
Yeah, I would say it's a demand that he divest his remaining stock holdings. He owns 50,000 shares stock options in Halliburton, and we're demanding that he get rid of them. He's already sold, last year he sold $6.9 million worth of profits in Halliburton stock.
So he made $6.9 mil?
Yeah.
He's got to be making more than that, though, Jim.
Well, he claims he's giving it to charity. Okay, he gave it to the Richard B. Cheney Cardiac Institute.
Right.
Most of it.
They're hiding the money.
Yeah, and so what he says is, well, I'm giving it to charity, mm-hmm. so I'm not really benefiting. Okay, and we're speculating that the remaining 50,000 shares that he has not sold, we're worried that he's not actually going to divest that money until he leaves office. In which case he can sell the stock, keep the profits, and not have to report it to the public because he'd be retired by then.
Sure. Yeah, he can contribute it to the Dick Cheney I Need a New Heart charity in his own house. So now I was doing a little research on Halliburton Watch. You're affiliated with a lot of good things. You want to tell us about a little bit of the history of it, where it came from, and who you are affiliated with?
We're affiliated with an organization called Essential Information, which mm-hmm. is based in Washington, D.C., and the Center for Corporate Policy, which is corporatepolicy.org. And that we're basically a corporate reform advocates. That's what we do. We're very critical of corporations. We put out a magazine called the Multinational Monitor, which it gets a lot of attention.
Now, this thing you issue every year, I'm assuming you issued it yearly. This is Hurricane Halliburton. I'm holding it right now. You can print it online. You can go to my website and link to Halliburton Watch. It's very clever. It's very funny. It's presented. It's funny only in the sense that you've put together an alternative annual report on Halliburton. And right here in the beginning, in the introduction, you basically say what the goals are. And it says, in this report, we will document some of the sources for Halliburton's profit, how the company management in Iraq and Kuwait has cheated taxpayers out of millions of dollars through bribery and waste, how the company has increased its profits in Iraq by employing sweatshop Asian labor and refusing to pay injury claims, how senior management used workers' pensions to pay for management benefits despite the fact that the soaring stock price has made the top managers tens of millions of dollars. This is phenomenal because talk about Halliburton,
right.
But it's really true,
right? And you know, it would be comical if it wasn't so deadly,
exactly.
You know, and I find myself giggling too, and you know, it's a way of releasing anger and frustration about what's going on. Mm-hmm. You know, and you do that here, which is great,
mm-hmm.
and that's what I'm doing when I posting a new article on the website. It's
sure.
amazing the insanity that's going on.
Well, let's talk about it in a non funny way if we can.
Sure.
I mean, because you go into specific areas. In the report, and there's a lot of things I don't think people do know. Like, I'm assuming that there was some – how many billions of dollars are still missing from, you know, suitcases full of cash that went into Iraq of taxpayer money?
Yeah. $8.8 billion is right now considered – was reported by the Iraq Inspector General for Reconstruction. He issued a report saying $8.8 billion cannot be accounted for. We don't know where close to $2 billion of Halliburton's expenses have gone.
So when you say expenses, that means they overcharged, they charged for work that either wasn't done or did not look like it would cost that much money.
Yeah, it was either an overcharge.
Right. That's
that. Yeah, or there is no verification as to where the money was spent.
Okay.
You know, it's like if I did a job for you and you were going to reimburse me the expenses, you would want to see what I spent the money on, right?
Right.
Well, in many instances, there are hundreds of millions of dollars in Halliburton expenses that they can't give an answer as to where this money went. They just said, hey, Mr. Pentagon, pay me now. And the Pentagon, of course, did pay them, even after their own auditors. This isn't me, you know, Jim Donahue at Halliburton Watch saying that they've overcharged. This is the Pentagon auditors, a little watchdog agency within the Pentagon that's saying all these things.
See, this just supports something that I have felt is true, is that these guys, they don't care about human lives. They don't care about the war itself. Someone's making a killing. Fortunes have been built on this money you're talking about, this stolen money from American taxpayers.
Right. And Halliburton, as of last year, had received over half the money that has been spent by American taxpayers in Iraq. They've got something like 52% of that.
Now, has there been any charges of malfeasance? I mean, have there been corruption charges? Because I noticed in the report you do mention that there have been some indictments, yeah?
Against employees, yeah, for taking kickbacks. But there has been no real prosecution on the $1.8 billion in overcharges and unverified expenses by Halliburton. There's been – The Pentagon has just paid them that money and said, it's all right. You don't have to worry about explaining where that money went.
Because it's business as usual with this particular group of idiots.
Exactly.
Now, let's talk a little bit about some of these other contracts because you go over in the annual report. Now, by the way, did you go to the Halliburton annual report meeting?
Yeah, I went to the annual shareholder meeting last week, and it was in Oklahoma. I didn't get into the meeting, but I was outside with the Hellraisers, and we had as many protesters there as there were shareholders.
How many is that?
200.
Wow.
Yeah, they usually hold the meeting in Houston, Texas, and they have for the last 40 years. And because the last few years have been difficult for them because all these protesters show up, the company decided to hold the meeting in Duncan, Oklahoma, which is like this little town in the middle of nowhere. And that's the reason why I went. I said, well, if they're going to run from us, then I got to go to Duncan, Oklahoma.
That's phenomenal because I had no idea that people were showing up in
yeah,
mass every
really,
year.
Yeah, since the war began, yeah, people have been showing up, and people from Houston, activists from Oklahoma City, everybody just – it was a very quickly organized thing where they had caravans of people – coming, and we were, you know, screaming at the shareholders as they were coming out of the meeting, saying things like, how do you sleep at night, and shame on you, and, you know, I think, and
can I borrow $1 billion, please?
Can you spare a quarter?
Of $1 billion?
Yeah. So, you know, I think, and the thing is Halliburton wants out.
Yeah.
This is my opinion. I think they want to get out of Iraq. They made their money, and they're, and it's too hard now. And they've even, like...
It's too hard to steal.
Yeah. It's... A year ago, they bailed out of their Iraq oil reconstruction contract because it got too difficult and because the insurgency is so intense.
Mm-hmm.
And they're still there building bases and helping supply the troops and all that. But in terms of the oil business, they want out.
Isn't that – that's bizarre. So now they're going to start to go other places where they can go under the radar.
Right.
And you talk a little bit in this report, you talk about disaster contracts. Now, this is contracts I'm sure that – I know that the – here's the other thing I want to talk about Halliburton. How many front companies are they operating? I mean, how many names – like, I know that money – they subcontract sometimes, don't they?
Most
I know
of the time.
Kellogg Brown Root is a subdivision of Halliburton.
Right.
But they – but Kellogg Brown Root – will also subcontract to other allies like Joe Alsbaugh in New Orleans, who used to be – who was the guy that got Michael Brown his job.
See, that's the problem. Everybody thinks privatizing all this stuff is a great idea. It just ends up costing the taxpayer more money because you have to – you create all these subcontractors.
Right. And then the one thing privatization does never ever really talks about is greed and the ability for them to do crappy work because they can get away with murder.
Exactly.
Let's finish talking about that. We're with Jim Donahue. We'll talk a little bit about where some of that Katrina Halliburton money has gone. Stay with us.
This show will be fresh until June 2007. Mark Maron.
Okay. All right. Man, I got that weird coffee head. Coffee head mixed with the sort of Monday tired. I was watching we have a guest in the studio, but I'm going to talk about myself for a minute.
Well.
Jim Donahue's here, co-founder of Halliburton Watch. And for some reason, I need to tell you right now, Jim, that the guy who comes and watches the Sopranos at my house every Sunday night came in with 3 quarts of ice cream. And he plowed through one by himself, and he left 2 in my house, and I had to eat one before I went to bed.
A whole quart?
Well, I've got ice cream hangover. No, pint. Good call. Good call. Quart would be sickness.
Yeah.
Pint is just a little bit of a problem.
You know who can help you with that?
Who?
Halliburton.
Halliburton. Well, thank God. What can Halliburton do to help me with my ice cream addiction? Jim Donahue is here from Halliburton Watch It, an awesome, awesome organization. You can link to it right there on our website. We're talking about privatization. And that's the interesting thing because you're allied with the – what's the name of the corporate watch group?
Corp Watch. Yeah.
Because this administration has legislated the corporate ability to do just whatever they want and incorporate anything, you know, human life – into their bottom line.
Mm-hmm.
With the tort reform legislation, no one can sue. There's no punishing corporations.
Right.
So it almost becomes – it's horrendous.
They did the same thing in Iraq. You can't sue a company if they were paid in Iraqi funds.
And that means what?
It means that a company in Iraq who was paid with Iraq funds can do whatever they want, treat the workers like hell, and not be sued for it, can rip people off. And if it was with Iraqi funds that they were paid with – you can't sue the company.
There's no legal recourse.
Yeah, right.
For anybody.
Exactly.
It's kind of
like book. It's kind of like NAFTA. I mean, there's a Section 11 of NAFTA you can't sue the company if the company destroys the environment or the city around you. You know, basically.
They work all that kind of stuff: environmental policy and also immigration policy. It's all tied in with a country that has been made completely corporate-friendly and completely works against the individual.
Right. You're seeing, I think, a merger of corporate power with government power.
Corporatocracy.
Yeah, and I think Mussolini called that fascism. At least that's one of the tenets.
Absolutely. We're just disposable. We're grist for the mill. We're just human fuel.
As a matter of fact, I remember I got a call back from a guy at Pentagon, one of the auditors, and on the caller ID, when he called me back, it said Halliburton. And I said, wait a minute, I thought you worked for the Pentagon. And he said, I do. I said, but the caller ID says you're calling from Halliburton. And he had no explanation. He didn't know why that was.
Really?
Yeah.
That's he didn't say, oh, my name's Bob Halliburton. Bob Halliburton's my name.
No. This is just the part of the whole cluster of just merging together private power with government power to the point where corporations are no longer accountable and Congress isn't paying attention. They don't care.
Well, I think they're paying attention, but half of them are owned by corporations.
Well, there you go. What I mean is they don't care with regards to me and you.
I know. It kills me. And when we're talking about New Orleans here and about these contracts, these disaster contracts, and Joe Albaugh was the guy who I was trying to remember who used to be the head of FEMA and now is in the private sector and subcontracting on his own.
Right.
And Halliburton has how many of the contracts there?
They've so far received $300 million. And I'm sure that number will rise as we go forward.
And there was initially when some of the work started being done, they were trying to make it so they didn't have to honor any sort of wage law.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I can't remember what that law was, but they said that they could bring in whoever they wanted. They suspended affirmative action hiring policies.
Right. They exported their Iraq situation to New Orleans.
Exactly.
Nobody wants that. You know,
no.
What they did in Iraq should disqualify them for being involved in any way in New Orleans.
Because half of that money is going to be just pilfered. It's going to be overcharges. Have they had any indication of that?
Yeah, the Defense Department is investigating. There was something on our website I wrote a couple of months ago.
Uh-huh.
They're actually now investigating. The auditors that I spoke about, the watchdog, they're the only people in the Pentagon who are actually beneficial to Mr. and Mrs. Taxpayer. It's like the one agency which, you know, is actually pretty good, okay?
Mm-hmm.
They get constantly overruled by the politicians at the top. But they are now investigating overcharges by Halliburton in New Orleans. I mean, and why is anybody surprised?
Absolutely. But the bigger question is when some of these government agencies, given the climate of Washington, do these investigations and they release these reports, usually, you know, on a Friday night or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Is what does it really facilitate? I mean, the information is out there.
Mm-hmm.
This is the mind-blowing thing about the sort of thankless job that you're doing and the thankless job that a lot of people are doing when they have both houses and culture doesn't seem to give a crap outside of the 200 people or the people in the circles that we're talking about. Is that how does that information get out there in a way that actually facilitates change?
Well, let's face it, you know, people are angry, I think, more than any of us think. I think as long as we keep talking about it, and I agree with you, it's frustrating.
Mm-hmm.
You've been talking about it, and you've been talking about it for a long time, and nothing ever seems to get done because the Republicans are in control, you know.
But you're saying the word gets out there, it starts to infiltrate people's head.
Yeah.
Like the word Halliburton, in and of itself, represents, you know, everything evil.
Uh-huh.
It is bandied about more than any other corporation ever.
Right.
In terms of, like, any time there's sort of like, you know, if an entire – Halliburton is just the catchphrase for all corporate evil in the world.
Yeah, we need to understand that it's not just Halliburton, you know. It is a whole bunch of companies.
Culture.
Yes, it's a culture, exactly, a culture.
A corporate culture of greed, of bribes, of money laundering, of all kinds of badness.
And they can get away with it, especially Halliburton. They know that, you know, Dick Cheney's going to step in if anybody tries to do anything to convict Halliburton. You know, they're being investigated by three federal agencies, the SEC, the Justice Department. And so there are criminal investigations going on against Halliburton right now, believe it or not, in the federal government. But they're just languishing, and it's been going on for years, and nobody – it's like it's on – they put it on a shelf. They announce there's an investigation, right?
Right.
And then they just leave it there and don't do anything. They don't conclude it.
And yeah,
I'm thinking they're going to conclude it in the next administration,
right.
In 2009 or assuming
– They've just got an intern working in there now.
Yes.
What are you working on? I'm doing the Halliburton investigation.
The Halliburton file.
Yeah. So in terms of the other companies we were going to talk about, that the front companies are these subsidiaries of Halliburton, how many are there and what are their names? Do you know?
Well, Kellogg Brown and Root, KBR, is the main one.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's the one you should talk about. What you're thinking about is the subcontractors,
right.
I believe. They're not subsidiaries of Halliburton.
Right.
That's what's very lovely about the setup is
right.
that they task the subcontractors to do all the work and to commit all of the the bad things like overcharge. And then Halliburton can sit back and go, well, I didn't know that Mr. and Mrs. Subcontractor here was overcharging. It's not my fault.
Sure.
You know.
And a lot of times, isn't it the case that some of those companies are set up to take the hit like that?
Yeah, exactly. And Halliburton is set up. They have a shoddy accounting system. The way they report their expenses to the Pentagon has constantly been criticized by the auditors, by the mm-hmm. Pentagon auditors. And so what happens is, Halliburton can come forth and say, well, our record keeping system isn't very good, and that's how we didn't know that there was an overcharge, and please excuse us and we'll fix it now. But how many times have we been overcharged when nobody found out about it? You know, I'm saying there's way more money that nobody's talking about that we've been overcharged with.
Sure, you know? Sure, absolutely.
We're only capturing part of the crime here.
So now, okay, so if people go to, I know the link is on my website, it's HalliburtonWatch.com?
.org, two L's in Halliburton, HalliburtonWatch.org.
You can get the big alternative annual report. Now, what are your recommendations for the company?
Well, what we'd like to see, this is really a problem of congressional oversight. We want to see a committee established by Congress that Truman did back in World War II
uh-huh.
to investigate, a separate committee that does nothing but investigate cronyism, investigates overcharges and the contractors in Iraq, but Congress refuses to do that. And we could save billions of dollars. They did it during World War II. It cost $15 million to establish this committee in World War II, and they saved something like $15 billion in overcharges. You know, just fraud didn't happen because we caught it in time,
yeah.
You know?
I just think that these guys, they don't care about that. They want to get away with this.
They
know that their days are numbered on some level,
right.
And that the damage is already done.
Exactly.
I really like the on the front page of the site, the graphs you have of Halliburton stocks going up with the number of lives in Iraq going up. It was very powerful.
Yeah, the KIAs. The number of soldiers killed in Iraq, the chart goes up at the same rate that Halliburton's stock price goes up in the last 3 years.
It's a very effective, a powerful analogy. Thanks so much for being with us, Jim Donahue, co-founder of Halliburton Watch. It was great talking to you.
Thank you. It was an honor to be here. Thanks
okay,
a lot.
Take care. We'll be back with jokes and some other stuff we wanted to talk about, Jim, the secular versus non-secular selfishness
still
issue.
Mulling that over.
And also the most popular, the sexiest vegetarian. You didn't make it.
Depressed because you haven't heard anything funny yet? Well, me too. Well, all that's about to change, maybe, because Mark Maron's Short Order News is coming up next.
Please review the enclosed document carefully. Mark Maron.
Oh, man, I don't know what the hell is going on with me today. It's been like that all day. I feel like I've been smacked on the head by a cast iron waffle iron. A cast iron waffle skillet. A waffle iron
with Teflon.
Casted. With no Teflon. No Teflon. Just going to...
The new coating.
Oh, I went to yoga, man. I went to yoga yesterday, and today I literally, whatever it's doing for my joints and muscles or whatever it may be doing for my disposition, I felt like I was 90 this morning getting out of bed. I had to throw my legs over the side of the bed, and I stood up and was like, I'm too young to be making those noises, all right?
You felt like a wise old man, though.
Is 90. It good? Is it bad? I don't know, Jim. I don't know what the hell. I got to get my bike fixed.
I bought a new refrigerator.
Wow.
So that tops you.
Good for you, new refrigerator guy.
Yeah.
How's that?
It's really frozen in there.
It's cold.
Incredible. Frosty glasses.
It's got the new cold. You're frosting your glasses? What, are you running an A&W out of your house?
Frosting glasses for the beer.
Ooh, are you really?
Yeah.
Oh, you're so funny. You are, aren't you?
I like my, you know, I like the Chimay and the Duvels. The monk beers.
You're into the fancy beers, huh?
Well, they're fancy. They're not fancy where they come from in Holland and Belgium.
Sure they are, but just by virtue of being in Holland, that makes them fancy.
Oh, man, those are beers.
They're not construction site worker beers, are they?
They're just guys living alone in their little hovels making beers.
How is that not special? I hate to break it to you, but Prince has been voted the world's sexiest vegetarian by PETA in an online poll. Yeah. So, were you involved in that at all? Did they have you listed?
I didn't know about it. I didn't hear about it. So it was not a valid poll.
I'll tell you, when we get syndicated, which I hear is now, soon, your name's going to be out there so you can be available for this type of stuff. Because, you know, I would have liked to at least seen a runoff between Jim Earl and Prince as the sexiest vegetarian.
What about Hitler? Well, you know, Hitler was a vegetarian. Nobody talks about that.
Yeah, but, you know, it's such a black and white issue in terms of was Hitler sexy, was he not sexy? People were going to find him sexy. He's a very specific type of person, and I don't know if they're animal lovers, per se.
Most of a nation thought he was sexy for over 13 years.
Did they, though? Was that really the thing with Hitler? It's like, he's hot. Hitler is hot.
He had not to use the 13 again, but he had 13 girlfriends, two of whom... tried to commit suicide. I think one did.
Yeah, and one
over him.
And one testicle. I think it's important to
know. No, that's a myth. That was afterwards. That was after his body was burned. They only found one testicle, but the other one was later found. And I have it, by the way. It's on my shelf next to my preserved prunes.
You've got Hitler's missing testicle?
Well, I got his left nut.
Man, that's amazing. I think that's another name for a band. Hitler's missing testicle.
It's left nut.
And then it's just a picture of you on the cover. And it just says Hitler's missing testicle.
Okay, now I think you're making fun of me.
I am. Here's some email. I was listening to several podcasts driving to and from the Colorado Democratic Assembly, and I had several comments. Cerberus is the comic book. Cerberus is the watchdog of Hades. You told the story as the opposite. I don't think I did, but maybe I did. Maybe it went both ways. I don't know. I don't know if your telling was messed up or if the person who corrected you was wrong. Trivia. Cerberus is a misspelling of Cerberus, but they decided to go with it. That's very, very esoteric trivia for anybody who even read the comic book Cerberus.
Really?
Cerberus, sorry.
I didn't know. Oh, I didn't know that was a misspelling.
Here's where you were dumb. You ready?
Uh-oh.
Kuru is the disease you get from eating human brains.
Oh, yeah. I remember that.
Ah, see?
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a lot like mad cow disease, a prion disease. It showed up in New Guinea and it peaked in the 60s because, you know, back in the 60s, everyone was eating people's brains, man. You know, things were eating brains. You know, people were doing things to their brains, man. And Kuru was hot.
You ever eat live monkey brains?
Ugh. Anthropologists were instrumental in figuring out the cause because the distribution was baffling. Only women, children, and the elderly. This distribution was because the women were the ones who ate the brains and fed them to their children, etc. Jeez. Mom! All right. I read a book about it when studying for my anthropology degree. There you go.
Kuru.
Kuru, I think. Isn't it? Kuru, just Kuru. I'm thinking of some other thing. South Park is another one. That's from, do I have to say the name? Hold on. No, I'm back on mic now. That's from Ramona in Boulder, Colorado. Here we go. This is from Sterling.
Sterling.
South Park is by far a right-wing show. Are you blind? Who was the villain in the Terry Schiavo episode? Mr. Schiavo, just like the right-wing media was pushing. They even used the same talking points. Get real, brother. Drop South Park like a bad habit. They're part of the problem. They've turned two of my friends into Bush-liking fascists through, quote-unquote, comedy. Maybe I think what you should be questioning is the integrity of your friendships and not so much the comic thing, not so much the South Park animated thing. They may be psycho-libertarian whack jobs, but there's still some funny crap on there, and they do take some shots at liberals. They do take some shots at right-wing people. I don't know the Terry Schiavo episode, but I'm not. I haven't watched it in a couple months, but I'm still. I'm not sold on the idea that it's right-wing.
I haven't watched it since they started making fun of you.
When did that happen? That is the best thing that could happen to us.
Last few months.
You know, when I hosted a morning show in New York, I could have set myself on fire and not gotten press. Fire. I could have set myself on fire.
Explains your missing left leg.
What about my missing left nut? Is that on your shelf next to Hitler's?
Yeah.
Huh?
I hope so.
Why does it got to get filthy?
You got to get some perks.
We cannot do morning show style things here. It's late at night for us.
We're just talking. This is the way we always talk.
I hardly ever talk to you.
See?
All right. Here we go. Roxy writes, on a more personal note, this is my anger problem. I gotta get to the joke.
What about Sterling? What kind of name is Sterling? Who names their children Sterling?
He's
anymore?
All worked up about South Park and talking points. Look, if a TV show or animated thing is going to turn your friends into people who like Bush, what the hell? I mean, I feel bad for that guy. I gotta do the jokes here in a minute, but this is on my rage issue. I gotta take care of that. It's not funny anymore. Like, you know, we talked about it with Mishnah and it got awkward. Well, it's still awkward and I still got to take care of it. And I got to go. I thought that anger management was like Weight Watchers. They just were in malls. Like there were centers you could go to with other angry people. You just walk in and people just looking at you. Yeah, what do you want? Look, I'm pissed. Oh, I'm pissed. I'm more pissed than you.
What about just a therapist? You know, therapists know about anger. They know how to stop it.
Can I read this letter from Roxy quickly? Sure. On a more personal note, at times when I have been experiencing frequent rage attacks, I found several things helpful. Breaking something. Good advice. I would save chipped glasses, dishes, plastic stuff at one end of a nice long hall, and when I wanted to scream at someone or something, I'd go for the pile. Well worth the cleanup. That actually is a pretty good idea. I also took drum lessons for a while after I quit smoking cigarettes since I really needed to beat on something. I switched to hand drums since I found my loud lack of coordination too frustrating. Drums and breaking glasses. I like the breaking glasses thing. Nothing more sad. One time when I was younger, I threw a beer bottle down a hallway that was still half full. And when I was yelling at something, there was someone there. I'm not going to go into specifics. But it hit the wall, and it didn't break. It just kind of went boonk and slid down the wall and spilled all over the place. Very unsatisfying. No closure. Hey, we don't want you to be caught off guard or uninformed. Here's a short order news. Federal investigators revealed in court papers that they videotaped Louisiana Democratic Representative William Jefferson accepting a leather briefcase packed with $100,000 in cash from a government witness in a bribery investigation. Historians say it's the first time a Louisiana politician has been involved in a corruption scandal in over 23 minutes. Voters reelected Ray Nagin as mayor of New Orleans, giving him 4 more years to oversee one of the largest rebuilding projects in U.S. history. In a press briefing, President Bush congratulated Nagin on his victory before staring into the cameras and blurting out, "Kanye West hates white people." This fall, Christie's will hold the first official studio auction of memorabilia from all 5 Star Trek television series and 10 spin-off movies. The auction comprises some 4,000 items destined to be put on shelves in basement apartments by guys trying to ignore the desperate pleas of their parents to go out and get a job, for Christ's sake. That's short order news for today. Do we talk about everything? Oh, Jim McGreevy, the former governor of New Jersey, wrote a book, and I'm going to quote him. "The closet starves a man, and when he gets a chance, he gorges till it sickens him." End quote. It's heavy. Heavy stuff. Tomorrow, Jim Norton, not the comedian Jim Norton, J.R. Norton. J.R.? Yeah. Author of Saving General Washington. Kirsten Powers, Democratic strategist. And Shyla Dewan for a New Orleans update. Big stuff. It's Monday, people. Good night, sheeple.